702. The Naked Scientist.
It is a Monday. It's after 2:30, and that means we're talking science with the Naked Scientist. That's Chris Smith, the Chair of Science at the University of Cambridge. Chris, hi. Can we let's check how the sound is now?
Oh, I hope so. I hope we're in good shape.
Yes, we are. We're in good shape. I was saying that we helped to make a centenarian's birthday super special today. So it's put everybody in a good mood. She's going to be flying to go see her sister for the first time in many, many years this coming Wednesday. So that's why we're all happy.
Oh, happy birthday. Happy birthday. We also made a promise last week. Do you
yes,
remember?
I do.
I'm very grateful to the person who called in and said and asked the question because I'd never really even thought about it. And when I went and did a bit of research, the question related, of course, to the staff with wings on the top and the snakes wound around it, which seems to be intrinsically bound up with the medical profession, where that relationship stemmed from. And I found it really interesting when I delved into this. As far as I can tell, the caduceus, which is the name of that staff with the wings on the top and the snakes wound around it, this actually originally had nothing to do with medicine. The first proper use in modern day medicine is probably from 1902, and that was the US Medical Corps who adopted it and put it on the uniforms of their medical officers. And that's probably where it then got intrinsically bound up with the medical profession proper. But there's interestingly some further backstory to this, because if you go back to the time of King Henry VIII in the UK, so we're talking 1500s, his personal physician was Sir William Butts. And Sir William Butts actually is said to have used that symbol in association with his practice. So there might be a weak association that perhaps the Americans got the idea from him.
Yeah.
But also, John Caius, who founded Caius College, Cambridge, which was Stephen Hawking's college, he was also the president of the Royal College of Physicians, and he had an actual physical caduceus. And he gave it to the college when he died. He used to have it in the college, and they still have it in the college to this day. So he was a medical man. He used it too. So there seems to be a sort of checkered history of people who've used this symbol, and they were medical, and it seems to have then been appropriated by the medical profession in some places as representing the practice of medicine.
But we're still not sure about the symbolism of that sword and the snake and the relevance of the
two. No, I mean, it's actually the symbol of Hermes, who was the messenger. So why we think maybe it's a medical messenger, not sure. But it may well be that those people felt that they were messengers of medicine, and therefore they used it, or they just liked it. And because they were medical, it then got appropriated by the medical profession in some places.
Yeah, so then became popularized even more in the previous century, 1902, you say. Very interesting.
Exactly right, yeah.
Thank you for that, and I hope that the listener is with us today to hear the feedback after that question, because I've come across so many different, over the years, so many different explanations. So thank you for this account, Chris. Let's go to Paul. Paul is calling from Randburg. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Vinnie. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
My question is to you with the explanation of infinity and how it relates to us as human beings and the universe, which is constantly expanding. And I've watched numerous YouTube videos, and it's infinity, they say, is a trillion to the power of a trillion. So how would you explain it? Because I've looked at the Fibonacci sequence, and I've looked at numerous other quantum physics equations, and all of them seem to have a different perspective on parallel universes, on black holes, on atoms, on protons, on neurons, and I was just trying to find out a bit more about it.
Chris?
So is the question really about infinity, or is the question about parallel universes and all the other?
Parallel universes and infinity and expanding universes.
Because they're all very different things. Infinity is a mathematical thing, which we use this to represent something that has no end. So if you take a number, you could double it, you could continue to double it, and then you could add one on the end and think of the biggest number that you think could ever exist. You can always add one on the end. That's infinity. So it's used to describe something which continues on inexorably as a sequence without any obvious end point. Now, in terms of how that relates to the universe, most of what we understand about this is all theoretical, because there are very few experiments we can actually do to say it's one way or the other, because, to be honest, we just don't know. Therefore, what we have to do is we come up with ideas about how these things may work, and then we come up with experiments to test those ideas, and we are slowly ruling things out, but we only very rarely rule things in. So in terms of parallel universes, this is one spin-off of one aspect of physics where people say, well, we could make our theory fit this particular model. There may well be lots of multiple universes and we inhabit one of them, and one way to test that is that we don't think anything goes between the universes except possibly gravity, and that might be why gravity has some of the strange force effects that it does, and therefore we might be able to detect parallel universes by looking for gravitational waves propagating between the two. So we'd do some experiments for that. In terms of how big the universe is, we don't know how big the universe is. We have an idea that it might be a kind of flat sheet that actually goes on forever and then curves back on itself in some way. We just don't know, to be honest.
Right. Paul?
Okay. Right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That's Paul in Randburg. As I said, I'm always so fascinated about the things that we're curious about. Next, let's go to John in West Dean. Hi, John.
Hi, Zemi. How are you?
Very good. And you?
Fine, thank you. I just wanted to speak about, you know, these brass handles on the windows,
yeah,
and the brass sliders on the windows. There's a friend, somebody mentioned it to me, that you can, I've been cleaning them with brass, but they don't really come up nicely. There's a certain liquid that you can put them in, and you leave them in for a day or two, mm, and they come out like brand new.
Okay.
What is this liquid that I can use?
You don't know the brand name, or just really know about how to clean brass?
Yes, apparently it just burns it off.
Ah.
It's a very powerful liquid.
Oh, I see. Chris, how do we clean brass? What's the best way of removing,
well, the,
is it oxidation?
The,
or?
Yeah. Deposits on brass, because it contains copper, there'll be an oxide layer, mm-hmm, a copper oxide layer. And when we clean these things, actually what we're doing is putting something on there which is pretty nasty, which strips away the surface.
Yeah.
And it wipes away the oxide layer, leaving the fresh, pristine metal underneath again, which then will slowly re-oxidize.
Mm-hmm.
But there is actually a product called Brasso, and it contains a range of organic solvents which are slightly mildly acidic, and they will get underneath the oxide layer, liberate it, and then disclose perfect shiny metal again underneath. But it'll only stay shiny as long as it takes to oxidize, and often it builds up a sulfur layer as well. If you're,
yes,
in a very polluted, air-polluted area,
yes,
it will grab sulfur from the atmosphere and stick that on there too. I think you can get a sulfide layer on it. So that may be why, if you're in a very high traffic area and there's a lot of sulfur in the traffic fumes, this can make certain surfaces, silver especially, tarnish,
mm-hmm,
more, and,
mm-hmm,
I think also brasses as well. But Brasso is one particular chemical that you can use to clean it up.
But he says he's tried
vinegar as well.
That.
Vinegar works quite well.
Vinegar?
Mm.
Your regular,
you can
white
do quite an interesting thing
kitchen
if you,
vinegar?
Yeah, if you take copper coins, which tarnish and go a very dark, deep brown colour, if you dip those in vinegar and just leave them in there for about 15 minutes, you'll see, if you put, say, half the coin in and not the other half, when you pull it out, you'll see you've got this pristine pink lower half of the coin and a very tarnished top half of the coin. You can see the difference, and that's the oxide layer. And so vinegar will actually work for the same way. The acid can help to etch away the oxide layer, and you can then clean down to the metal.
Mm, there you go, John. Will you try vinegar?
Well, I've tried Brasso, but I'm going to try vinegar now.
Yes, yes.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
That's John in West Dean. Let's take a break with the naked scientist, Chris Smith, and let's take more of your calls after that on 011-883-0702. Earlier, a question about infinity and parallel universes. Yeah, I think I got stuck in another universe in that explanation. But then the Brasso question as well. So from the very intricate to the very everyday, the entire gambit right now, 011-883-0702.
702, The Naked Scientist.
It's 12 minutes to 3 o'clock and we continue with your calls. Eddie, thank you for your patience. You're calling us from Bryanston. Hi.
Hi there, Azania. Hi, Chris. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
So my question is as follows. My grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm,
and the doctor walked us through the neurological process in her head. He identified an abnormal buildup of protein being responsible for memory loss in Alzheimer's patients. That's why Alzheimer's patients can't remember as their nerves break down in their brain. Mm-hmm. So I just want to know, is there any correlation with the consumption of protein foods such as meat, poultry, even beans, with as regards to Alzheimer's? And why is Alzheimer's still such an elusive and misunderstood disease?
Mm-hmm. Right. Chris?
Hi, Eddie. The answer to this one is, first of all, what is Alzheimer's? Well, it's one of the what we call senile dementias. These are disorders that lead to a loss of cognition, usually with age, although there are forms of these diseases that can come on very early. But in Alzheimer's disease, if you look in the brain of a person who has this, what you see is a build-up, as you say, of a pathological protein. And this is a protein called beta amyloid. And it's actually made from aggregates or joining together of lots of small units of a protein called beta-APP. So the brain makes this chemical naturally. Nerve cells secrete it. And we don't really know what this chemical does, but we know that it's in some way linked to the brain, perhaps defending itself or using it in an anti-inflammatory way. But in some people, for some reason, this protein gets extra chemical groups added to it that makes it sticky, and it then clumps together. And these clumps, we think, are toxic, and they make nerve cells become oxidatively challenged. It basically stresses nearby nerve cells. Those stressed nerve cells then start to build up inside themselves another kind of pathological protein, which is called tau, which is part of the normal skeleton of the cell. And this also gets extra chemical groups added to it that shouldn't be there, that make it sticky. Mm. And these then build up and form tangles that then ultimately destroy the cell. So ultimately, you end up losing nerve cells. And as you lose nerve cells, you lose cognitive function. And the most commonly affected part of the brain, or at least the area of the brain where this tends to manifest first, are the brain's temporal lobes. And those are the regions of the brain roughly where you point at when you stick your finger in your ear.
Yeah.
And that region of the brain houses your hippocampus, which is your brain's memory circuits. And this is why people who develop Alzheimer's disease, before they develop frank dementia, will often say, my memory is beginning to let me down. Mm. And they also may struggle with other aspects of cognition, but that tends to come later. It's often a memory loss of day-to-day continuity of memory. And older memories remain intact, but the ability to form new memories and to understand what you've just done and where you've just been and to find your way around, those sorts of things begin to deteriorate. Now, why this happens, as I say, it is intrinsically linked to age. And as we have an aging population with more people living longer, we're seeing more people manifesting these things because historically, not enough people lived to reach the kind of age where this became much of a problem for them. In terms of what we can do about it, there are a number of things that are being investigated. There are ways to control the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, but there's nothing at the moment that actually stops the disease. Because to stop the disease, we would have to know that you were going to get the disease and then give treatment that would stop those proteins building up in the first place. Scientists are working on this, and they're working on biomarkers to predict it. But at the moment, where we are is that we can diagnose people who've got the disease. We can diagnose people who are going to get worse disease, and therefore we can give them symptom control drugs, and these include chemicals like galantamine, for example. These are drugs that help to increase the signaling of the neurotransmitters in the parts of the brain that are affected, which can help with the symptoms a bit, and it can leave a person functioning better for longer, so they have a normal life for longer. But ultimately, we've got no way at the moment of halting the disease, and that's a big priority for pharmaceutical industries all around the world, because we estimate that by the middle of the century, it might be as many as one person in five over a certain age to one person in three who is affected. So we're looking at a very, very big problem, which we're sleepwalking into at the moment. And we have to take this very seriously because it will rob us of so many resources and we won't be able to care for these people well enough if we're not anticipating this need that's coming.
Wow, Chris, thank you for that breakdown. Thank you for that explanation. As he says, there's just so much mystery around Alzheimer's, but biologically, we could see with our mind's eye what you were describing. Figile, hi.
Hi, Azania.
Hello, Figile.
Hi, Chris. Hello, Azania. Hi. Mm. Look, I wanted to find out from Chris from a scientific point of view. Look, they say hydrogen, when it burns, it doesn't have color, you know. So I wanted to find out what is the science or the chemistry behind hydrogen fire having no color at all. And if so, obviously, how do we then obviously bring color to that fire or to the hydrogen that is burning in the space.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, really interesting question, this one. First of all, why does any flame have a colour?
Colour.
The reason flames have colour, and if we look at, say, petrol burning or gas burning, often, say, your log stove has an orange flame. Why is the flame orange? The reason those flames are orange, or a candle has an orangey-yellow flame, is because there are particles which are being liberated from the fuel which are not burning. So you've got bits of carbon, and as you heat the carbon up in the flame, the carbon glows and gives out light, and we see that glowing carbon as orange light. Now, when you light gas on your gas stove, that has a blue flame, and scientists suspect that the blue colour is because when the gas burns, one of the products is water, but on the way to making water, it makes oxygen-hydrogen bonds, and those oxygen-hydrogen bonds probably interact with and absorb and then release light, which is of a blue colour.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when hydrogen burns, again, it makes water. So it does have a bluish flame. It's very, very subtle. There is a bluish tinge to the flame. So I think there probably is some of that OH bond there, which is producing a little bit of blue light. But hydrogen, very pure. There's nothing else, if you burn it in isolation, there's nothing else in the mixture. So there's nothing to give the flame a colour like there is for a candle, which is why you don't see an orange flame for hydrogen like you would off a log stove. And your gas ring, as I say, I think scientists, I was talking to someone about this the other day, actually, and he was saying they think that it's the hydrogen-oxygen bond, but we don't know for sure. And certainly it might be the CO bond, the carbon-to-oxygen bond, that's also contributing some of the colour. That won't be in hydrogen when it burns either, so that might be the reason.
That is such a fascinating question. At first I thought, what the hell? But once you started explaining even just the color of the logs, that it's now it's glowing carbon. Wow, never going to look at a fire the same again. Charles in Randburg. Hello, Charles.
Hi, good afternoon to the both of you.
Yes, hi.
Quick question, but I know I want to have a quick answer. There are lots of theories about what happened right backwards up until the Big Bang theory.
Yeah.
Are there any theories about what happened before the Big Bang?
Before the Big Bang, Chris, what existed?
No, I mean, as far as we know, that's the moment of creation of our universe, which is why people are speculating about the possible existence of other universes, because some people speculate that perhaps a Big Bang, when a universe pops into existence, could be coming from, for want of a better phrase, the arse end of a black hole in another universe. So perhaps everything gets squeezed down into a black hole and it then explodes into a white hole, Big Bang, creation of a new universe at the other end of that black hole. Who knows? But we've very limited ways of probing this, because although we can get back in time by looking at what we dub the echoes of the Big Bang, radiation left over from our Big Bang in our universe, which are still echoing around all over the place, and we can pick that up. It's called the cosmic microwave background radiation, and we can read into that radiation, or can read from it and deduce from it some of the conditions that were happening right back early in the universe, and we can superimpose on that our understanding of physics and chemistry to understand how the various molecular species that now dominate in the universe came about. We have very good models for that, but that only gets us back as far as what we think happened as far back as the Big Bang. What happened before that, we have absolutely no idea, and it's very, very difficult to test, because we can't just watch a Big Bang happen and then say, oh, that's how it all happened and that's where we came from. So we don't know. It's pure speculation.
Pure speculation. Thanks for the question, Charles, and everybody else who called in. We always learn something with you, Chris. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That is Chris Smith, the Chair of Science at the University of Cambridge, our Naked Scientist, every Monday after 2:30.